Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is the March 11th podcast, 2023, almost 50 years after Ronald Reagan's Welfare Queen speech that launched the presidential bid for U.S. presidency in Mississippi. We have seen the rise of domestic surveillance since the mid-70s, unbeknownst to the general public. Politico.com has a secret surveillance program inside the United States that they have uncovered. From Asheville, North Carolina, we've got a story about mutual aid and charges of felony littering, aid and abetting felony littering for feeding the homeless under the authority of the Director of Parks and Recreation. When sandwiches are outlawed, only outlaws will have sandwiches. We've got Atlanta City Council member Liliana Bakhtari, who says that Atlanta Police Foundation has been stonewalling the City Council and not answering their questions. From the Alphabet Boys podcast, we have a story about Ratfuck Nikki in Denver, a paid informant to disrupt the George Floyd protests in Colorado. Would you believe there are 15,000 paid informants in the United States? We're going to follow up on the March 4th rally to stop Cop City. It'sgoingdown.org, their report back from Atlanta support groups where environmental movements from around the world is showing support like never seen. And what is a bouncy house? And why is the Atlanta Police Department sticking AR-15 rifles inside a child's playpen? These are some of the questions asked the Atlanta City Council on Monday. Then we check in with the Blue Ridge Anarchist Black Cross and their mutual efforts in the region. It now requires a permit to host a drag show in Tennessee. We'll hear from a J6 martyr who speaks from the grave in a rant about feces in the streets. Is that a metaphor or just a manic high? March 8th was International Women's Day. We have a statement from the Women's Army in Rojava. Channel Z Network, in a magazine they call System Fail from Submedia, with a current statement of war and peace. Southern Poverty Law Center and the National Lawyers Guild post a statement about the March 5th mass arrest, including two legal observers, on state charges of domestic terrorism. GrassrootsThinking.com, a 24-point statement by community movement builders. Atlanta Antifa has identified fake journalists interviewing forest offenders. Be on the lookout for very short fascists. Music from Marianne Faithfull, The Clash, Ex-Vandals, and Michael River. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is from itsgoingdown.org, March 6, 2023. The amount of solidarity is incredible here. Voices on the front lines of the fight to stop Cop City. A massive victory is how one participant, Gene, who spoke to It's Going Down in a recent interview, described this weekend's mobilization against Cop City in Atlanta. The movement is currently at a high point following an outpouring of support and rage over the brutal murder of Manuel Tortajita, an anarchist and forest defender, who was shot and killed by law enforcement during a raid on tree sets and protest encampments on January 18th. Statements of solidarity and support have come in from across the left and the environmental movement, spanning from the Sierra Club to 350.org, to grassroots collectives and organizations all over the United States and the world. Atlanta Community Press Collective tweeted, "Welcome to day two of Defend the Forest Week of Action. There's a new addition to the space by the festival grounds on the RC Field tarmac." This is a reference to the Bouncy House. An excited group of festival goers jumped in and as soon as the setup was complete. The weekend also shows the movement has staying power. For over 2 years, the autonomous and decentralized struggle to defend the Walani Forest has fought to oppose the construction of a massive corporate-backed 85-acre police counterinsurgency training facility, as well as contested land grab by Ryan Millsap of Black Hall Studios, the company behind such films as Venom and Jumanji reboots. Groups such as Community Movement Builders, which organize in working class and poor black communities, and local environmental coalitions have been in the forefront of the battle, which has been marked by everything from marches organized by local school children to targeted property destruction claims via anonymous communiques on the websites like Scenes from the Atlanta Forest. As one forest defender described the recent podcast, people used to like to use the term diversity of tactics, and we've gone a step further. We've created something that actually mimics the forest itself. This is an ecosystem of tactics. So it's not a bunch of things working against or in spite of each other. It's several tactics working in conjunction and relation to each other. Everything from Muskogee stomp dance to marches of preschoolers to leafleting the community old school style, to windows being smashed, to people building tree houses in the forest and refusing to move. It's punk shows and dance parties and religious services and garden planning. And a lot of these things are difficult for some people to understand why they matter, why they connected to each other. But it's important to understand that we have to reach out to every aspect of human society. According to folks on the ground, over 1,000 people answered the call to take part in the most recent week of action, which kicked off this Saturday, marking the largest number of supporters which has ever mobilized as things began in the early morning of Saturday, March 4th. Around 10:30 a.m., protesters gathered at Grisham Park listening to various speakers ranging from local organizers with Community Movement Builders to clergy before marching nearly 2 miles through the forest to Walani People's Park, the site of some of the movement's first public gatherings and the remnants of a gazebo and paved trails which were destroyed by workers hired by Ryan Millsap. After arriving at Walani People's Park, the crowd then began setting up tents to camp in, communal kitchens, and a soundstage for a two-day music festival featuring a plethora of musical acts spanning a wide variety of genre. Over 1,000 people soon filled the space, enjoying literature, tables, and food, while volunteers, forest defenders, and festival participants worked to cook, set up sanitation, and created all sorts of communal infrastructure. It was an incredible project of social reproduction, Gene stated, complete with full kitchens, hand-washing, bathrooms, food, and multiple kitchen stations. Defend the Atlanta Forest tweeted, "South River Music Festival under the nearly full moon and the cool breeze of some trees." This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is from itsgoingdown.org, March 6, 2023. Message from Yaqui political prisoner Fidencio Aldama to the National Indigenous Congress. "Hi, everyone. My name is Fidencio Aldama Perez. I am a member of the Yaqui tribe from the town of Loma de Bacum in the state of Sonora, Mexico, one of the 8 Yaqui towns which make up the Yaqui Nation, a town that has stood firm in struggle and resistance. I carry in my blood, flesh, and skin this grand history of the Yaqui Nation, which has for centuries struggled against extermination, violence, and territorial dispossession. Today, more than ever, I have embraced the words of the Yaqui Oath, those words that have been captured in my chest, that run in my blood. I have embraced the struggle and the history, which is the essence of my resistance and rebellion, which is autonomous with ancestral claims of education, security, justice, and spirituality. From our self-defense comes our self-government, because I am of Yaqui tribe and because capitalism was born from the blood of our people. We must collectively build, defend, exercise the agreements of the poor as the constitution of our people. We must continue existing with the self-determination and the autonomy to decide the manner we want to organize ourselves in our territory and the form of which we want to construct our future. This future will be governed by the following ideals: to serve and not be served, to build and not destroy. And, as I've always said, I do not attack, but rather defend what is ours, what our ancestors have left us. They have taught us to respect our roots, culture, traditions, and customs. With the white man, those allied with money have intervened, producing divisions in our communities. Even so, there are those of us loyal to the Yaqui Nation who don't bow before money, who carry in our hearts the Yaqui Oath. I'm still here, a land defender of the Yaqui tribe, and though I am locked inside the prison at Ciudad Obregon, Sonora, excluded from my customs and traditions, I won't give up the struggle. Rather, I will continue resisting, because my freedom won't come from some exchange, but will come from my innocence. I send a cordial greeting to the National Indigenous Congress, and I invite everyone to continue collaborating with and supporting me, giving me the strength to continue forward. I am grateful in advance for everyone's support and solidarity. Many thanks. March 4th, 2023.
December the 31st of 2022, there was a New Year's Eve noise demonstration downtown so-called Asheville, North Carolina.
So this year, Pansy Collective, which is a queer and trans DIY music and arts collective, teamed up with MADCO.
And MADCO is the Mountain Area Abortion Doula Collective, and we provide abortion access to folks in Western North Carolina as well as funding. And then the Blue Ridge Anarchist Black Cross, which is a group that does really amazing work, including but not limited to bailing folks out, supporting prisoners, and doing direct action. So all of these groups teamed up together to bring this year's New Year's Eve noise demonstration and bailout action to fruition, using the skills and the best parts of each of our groups to like bring a really solid action to the community. After that first initial meeting where we decided together that we were going to move forward with a bailout and a noise demonstration, we also knew that we wanted to get other folks involved in the community, like the medics, like the bike crew.
So in addition to bailing folks out, there was a lot of attention in getting folks trained to do jail support and then doing that jail support together, getting, you know, care packages together, cigarettes, tampons, whatever folks need when they're getting out.
We are really proud of the work that we did to bring together this action with the bailout, with the noise demonstration, and we are excited to see other groups take on these prison abolitionist commitments of bringing community together, bailing people out, supporting community, and doing mutual aid, and really putting community and care at the forefront of all of our strategies. We want to see that happen all across the world and all across the country.
We just voted to not have any type of regulation or safety precautions around the Second Amendment, but now we have a bill to regulate drag shows. Drag shows are not a threat to our community. Mass shootings are. The ridiculousness, the circus that is this body. Passing a bill to create a regulatory board of drag shows, the sponsor of the previous bill said that we should not regulate the Second Amendment. But when it comes to the First Amendment, members of this body have every intention and every comfort disrespecting, undermining, and regulating First Amendment's free expression clause. It's absurd that we are so threatened by drag shows, but we don't take seriously the real threats to our community. And I just ask my colleagues to look in the mirror. What is going on in this body? This is absurd. And I hope the sponsor of this bill will reconsider this attack on the LGBTQ community. These are not a real threat to our communities.
All we're doing is stating that a permit will be required.
So we need a permit to have a drag show, but we don't need a permit to carry a firearm. I mean, we talk about how the Constitution is our permit. Would the Constitution not be the permit of these drag performers who are exercising their constitutional rights? Reverend Doggett, have you been to a drag show?
Can I say that I have? No, sir.
Have you seen the governor's yearbook photos? I was just trying to think of an example that the representative might be familiar with. There's no harm there. We've already passed the bill targeting this community. Now you're expecting them to register with the state after you've already come after them to put their name in a registry so that you can target them even further. I mean, this bill is bullying on bullying. And I believe that the Constitution is their permit. If it applies to the Second Amendment, it should apply to the First Amendment as well. This bill is nothing more than hate in drag. It's nothing more than intolerance and targeting in drag. And it is shameful. It requires a permit for an activity that has not had any instance of harming our community where mass shootings have. And this body just said we don't need a permit to exercise the Second Amendment.
Aye, 74-23 nay.
House Bill 30, having received constitutional majority, everybody declare passed without objection. Motion brings to the table.
Human fecal matter off the road. That is a problem, okay? This is absolutely insane. The meth problem, the fentanyl problem, the heroin problem, the illegal... This is crazy, okay? Like, well, everybody wants immigration, but we need to do it the right and correct way. This is getting out of control, and you guys are lying. Why are you lying? Why are you lying? And why are you so worried about what everybody else is doing? I want to talk about what you're doing. Like I said, you can consider yourself put on notice. Me and the American people. I am so tired of this. I am woke, man. I am just... This is absolutely unbelievable. Get your shit together.
Before anything else, I want to make clear that I don't find it right to see only the 8th of March as the Day of Women. It is indispensable that every day has to be lived with women, with free women. But the reality of the 8th of March shows openly that there are no women accepted in the current life. Seeing it as worthy to remember her only on this day shows the deepness of slavery. This field is a working field for me that I constantly get deeper thoughts about. I don't see this field different from war. Just like in all revolutions and in the revolutions nowadays, the topic of women is the most important topic. In the revolution of Kurdistan, the most important topic to reach success is the analysis of the life around women. This topic is the most important one, from advanced problems of war to building up peace and all the developments on the basis of freedom, it has an important role. The 2000s will be the years of women's freedom, with the reawakening from the dark ages of civilization that left women in non-existence. I see the civilization as a dark era. However, in the beginning of the 2000s, the spring of women began. The freedom of women is building up anew. Like a snowdrop flower that ends the cold and darkness of winter and rises up against the hard ice of the oppressive male system, which is based on lies and violence throughout history. With this uprising, the spring and blossoming of women against snow and hard winter brings the blossoming of the women's freedom movement as well. I see this level as important. I build up a relationship with women, with my heart and my brain. This is my identity, my method, and how I see women.
Mickey did was essentially enter in as if he were an activist while being paid secretly by the FBI, and then became a leader of the movement in Denver and not only encouraged violence at protests, but then tried to entrap specific demonstrators or activists in federal crimes.
Yeah, your podcast talks about this reverse incentive for informants. Like, they're getting paid, in this case, tens of thousands of dollars to get dirt. Then Mickey ends up being a leader in the movement. So how did he actually influence the actions of the protesters?
Yeah, so it's important for context. You know, if you go back to the 60s during COINTELPRO under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI had 1,500 informants. Today it has more than 15,000, a tenfold increase. And informants can make a lot of money. They can make in excess of six figures a year. And obviously, if you're an informant for the FBI and you're hired on and you go into, say, a protest movement in Denver and you come back and say, look, all of these people are peaceful, I didn't find anything, you're not going to stay on the payroll. So there's a direct incentive to encourage and even facilitate criminal activity. And what Mickey did was he had gone into the protest movement and used a tactic known as snitch jacketing that goes back to the COINTELPRO days of Hoover, where he accused the real leaders of being informants themselves, sowing confusion and distrust and creating a leadership vacuum that he then filled. And then as the protests wore on that summer, he was encouraging what were otherwise peaceful protests to become violent. He was organizing them, hyping them up. He was encouraging people to bring weapons and body armor. And, you know, the question that we raise is, you know, to what extent did the government's role in Denver play in turning some of these protests very violent? And the larger question, I think, is, you know, was this anomalous or did this happen in other cities as well?
Hello. Welcome to System Fail, the show that speaks truth to power.
It is my great pleasure to present you with the Chief's Award for Valor. Congratulations. I'd like to give you an opportunity to say a few words.
Yes. I'm very uncomfortable being here with you guys. I do not rock with the police. And I just want folks to know that they don't keep us safe. We keep us safe. Riots work. Thank you.
I am your host, DDoS, and for months now, the drums of war have been growing louder.
84 missiles and 24 drones targeting at least 10 cities from one end of Ukraine to the other.
Revenge after a key bridge connecting Russia to Crimea was blown up this weekend.
Tensions in the Taiwan Strait.
The largest ever military maneuvers that China has done.
Are you willing militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
Could we be heading toward World War III?
You know, global thermonuclear war end-of-day scenario.
Despite the focus of Western media coverage, today's most deadly war is being waged in the territories ruled by the Ethiopian state. In Amhara and Afar, recent fighting has displaced tens of thousands of people from their homes, mostly women and children, while in Tigray, millions of people are being systematically starved to death under conditions of a government-imposed communications blackout, regular shelling, airstrikes, mass rapes, and other atrocities carried out by the Ethiopian and Eritrean armed forces. Turkey continues to wage a vicious and largely unreported war in Syria and Iraq, bombing Kurdish villages and repeatedly using chemical weapons against guerrilla fighters aligned with the Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK. And in Yemen, civilians are bracing themselves for a fresh round of fighting, following the collapse of a six-month ceasefire that had provided a temporary reprieve from 8 years of hell. Meanwhile, Putin's invasion of Ukraine and increased saber-rattling over Taiwan have ramped up geopolitical tensions between the world's so-called great powers to levels not seen since the Cold War. Geriatric politicians, some of whom look like they could barely fight a cold, have assumed the role of wartime leaders, framing armed conflicts over energy markets, trade routes, and so-called spheres of influence as epic clashes of moral, cultural, and national values.
Democracy will and must prevail.
Neo-Nazism and extreme nationalists.
The actual values in question have proven quite elastic. In Ukraine, Western media outlets have gone to great lengths to rehabilitate the neo-Nazis of the Azov Battalion, reframing them as misunderstood patriots, while RT and Sputnik have heaped praise on the neo-Nazis of the Wagner Group for their efforts to, quote, denazify the so-called Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republic. Beneath all the misinformation and patriotic spin lies the brutal reality of war, working-class humans, slaughtering one another for the vanity of politicians and the profits of their capitalist handlers.
When you look at the leadership that's come from the defense contractors, it's telling us that this conflict in Russia and Ukraine lasts longer than the consensus expects. It's giving us the same message that, say, the energy stocks or oil here is. So this idea of peak conflict or peak inflation or peak yields, I don't think the market is justifying any of those. Mm. And these defense contractors, I think, support that view.
But not everyone is going along with the plot. In Russia, a militant anti-war movement has risen up, launching a sustained, multi-pronged attack on the government's war effort. The Russian state, for its part, has arrested thousands of protesters for peacefully demonstrating their moral objections to the war. Which leads to an obvious conclusion. If all opposition is criminalized, you might as well make it count. Members of the Anarchist Communist Combat Organization, known by its Russian acronym, BOAK, have carried out dozens of acts of sabotage against railways aimed at disrupting the transfer of military equipment and ammunition. They have been joined by partisan counterparts in Belarus, whose sabotage of railways has disrupted Russian troop movements and played an important role in thwarting its initial invasion of Kiev. Meanwhile, within Russia, more than 50 military recruitment offices have been attacked since the war began, many of them set alight in brazen nighttime Molotov attacks. Government buildings and police vehicles have also been put to the torch. The pace of these attacks has intensified since Putin issued a decree on September 21st, mobilizing 300,000 reservists for active duty on the front lines. On September 26, a 25-year-old man named Ruslan Zinin shot a military officer in a conscription office in the Siberian city of Ustilansk after his friend had been called up for service. In Primorye, near the country's border with North Korea, the commissar in charge of regional mobilization and enlistment was found dead on October 14. Numerous protests have broken out in the country's Far East, as well as the Caucasus regions of Dagestan, Kabardino-Balkaria, and Chechnya, where the region's Putin-obsessed strongman, Ramzan Kadyrov.
I can't hide the way I feel about you anymore.
On the other side of the increasingly fluid border, a number of Ukrainian, Russian, and Belarusian anarchists have joined the Ukrainian war effort, integrating themselves within the national army in order to fight against what they see as the greater evil of Russian occupation. Other anarchists have maintained an active antagonism to Russia, NATO, and the Ukrainian state, which has enacted authoritarian wartime measures criminalizing dissent, limiting freedom of movement for refugees, and enforcing military conscription on all men and trans women between the ages of 18 and 60. On October 5th, the Ukrainian embassy in Prague was vandalized, and a communique was released blasting Zelensky for forcibly confining Ukrainian civilians who want to flee. It goes without saying. But Ukraine's oligarchs are not fighting on the front lines. Most of them fled the country for the safety of Western Europe as soon as the first bomb started falling. Meanwhile, in France, Germany, Italy, and Greece, anarchists have carried out a number of clandestine attacks against NATO military contractors and disrupted weapons shipments. Despite all the death, devastation, and divisions sparked by Russia's invasion, new solidarities are being formed between those fighting to end the war. It's worth noting that Russia's defeat in World War I, hastened by widespread defections and military sabotage, served as a primary catalyst for the February Revolution and the overthrow of the Tsar. History, as they say, doesn't repeat itself, but it sometimes rhymes.
When the dust...
I heard there's a party. You invited me to a party. I want to go to it. And yeah, just generally catch up. I mean, I'm kind of in the wind because I'm not really sure what. Anyways, I don't know what's going on. But you know, you heard that a bunch of my friends got. So yeah. Anyway, I'm doing all right. Hope you are too.
Why do we do this to ourselves over and over again? It seems like we're perpetuating our own
And in other news, in so-called Chile, on Tuesday, October 18th, nearly 200 people were arrested in protests, marking the third anniversary of the revolts that shook loose the government's control in 2019. Coordinated actions took place in cities across the country, including Santiago, Valparaiso, Concepcion, and the heart of indigenous Mapuche territory in Temuco. Fiery attacks destroyed three city buses in Santiago and logging equipment used to colonize the Mapuche homelands of Hualmapu. The Chilean Pacos were again caught on film trying to run over protesters and firing rocket-propelled tear gas canisters at eye level. 24 police and dozens of protesters were injured in the clashes. The day also witnessed calls of support and solidarity with the hundreds of prisoners who have remained caged since the 2019 revolts, as well as Mapuche political prisoners, like Hector Yaitul. We have now reached the end of this episode of System Fail. To support anarchist and anti-war prisoners in Russia and Belarus, consider following and donating to anarchist Black Cross chapters in Belarus, Moscow, and Irkutsk. You can support Submedia by buying some gear, making a one-time donation, or signing up to be a monthly sustainer on our website, sub.media. A huge thank you to our latest sustainers, Andrew, Alisa, Tyler, Cecilia, Michael, and B. Be sure to follow us on your favorite corporate data mining platform of choice, or on federated social media platforms like Mastodon or Peertube, by searching for Submedia. Or better yet, sign up to our mailing list to get each new episode delivered directly to your inbox. Godspeed, humans.
For 2 years, we have defended a forest in South Atlanta from those intent on destroying it. This is the Wilauni Forest. Those who want to destroy it intend to build a $90 million police training facility, Cop City, with roads to practice high-speed chases and a mock city to practice raids, explosive testing, crowd control, and other tactics of urban warfare. In response, we have protested, petitioned, put our bodies on the line, and put pressure on Cop City construction companies and funders. The climate crisis is already here. All across the world, people are fighting back against the destruction of their land, water, and local ecosystems. The police trained in Cop City will be used to brutally suppress the movements we need to wage these battles now and in the years to come. The struggle for life on Earth and the struggle to prevent the expansion of the police state are one and the same. This is not just a local struggle. With media attention on the rise, city officials are scrambling to control the narrative.
These individuals meant harm to people and to property.
This is a very small group of individuals.
Many of them don't even live in Atlanta or in the state of Georgia.
They have fabricated domestic terrorism charges, and they have done this precisely because the movement is strong. The police murder of Tortuguita and the ensuing cover-up could have chilled the movement, but instead it has only grown and spread. Together we will stand up for the forest, for the trees and the animals that live in it, and for each other. Wherever you are, we need you here. Come camp with us from March 4th through 11th for a week of action in the Wilauni Forest. Cop City will never be built. Wilauni Forest is and will always remain a public park.
Lieutenant Neil Wells, the police officer of the city of Atlanta. I hereby declare that being on this sidewalk, you are obstructing or impeding the normal and reasonable movement of pedestrian traffic in violation of Atlanta City Ordinance. In the name of the people of the state of Georgia, I hereby command that all present here in the sidewalk immediately exit the street or the roadway or sidewalk. If you do not do so, you may be detained or arrested. Should you fail to exit the sidewalk in accordance with this lawful command, you shall be in violation of Section 150266, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which prohibits standing or being on any street, roadway, or sidewalk in a manner to obstruct or impede the normal or reasonable pedestrian traffic.
Was there a proper area for media to document what's going on here?
Yeah, you guys are good. Thank you. Okay. We'll be right back.
this Atlanta City Council. My name is Reverend Kiana Jones, and I stand here before you as a member of the Faith Coalition to Stop Cop City. And I'm looking at each one of your faces, and I really want to understand how it is that you asked people to vote for you and then ignored their voices. How it is that you feel okay with yourself lauding Abel Mabel, who had a lot to say about treating people right, who had a lot to say about the words of the Bible that many of you like to quote. Well, let me remind you of something. Be not deceived, for God is not mocked, that whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. So understand this, that the sins of the father will be visited on the children. It has happened time and again. So it may not happen to you, but what about your child? What about their children? What about their children's children's children? What will your legacy be, you so-called legacies of black misleadership sitting up here on this council? Let me tell you something. Representation is not enough when you don't represent the people who elected you. The people came out and spoke clearly. And let me go to the Bible one more again and say that we are here as clergy to cry loud and spare not. We are opening our mouths and crying with a loud voice to say that we don't want Cop City. I live in East Atlanta. I don't want Cop City. I got 5 black children. I don't want Cop City. I like breathing clean air. I don't want Cop City. I want to drink clean water. I don't want Cop City. I don't want Black Hawk helicopters landing around the corner from my house. I don't want Cop City. I don't. My neighbors don't. My granny don't. She's been in her house almost 50 years, and you suckers will never get it through gentrification because we knew what to do. And Mary Norwood and the people of Buckhead, this will not be your trade-off. When are you going to stop dealing with the white supremacist infrastructure and dealing with the so-called black...
Drive by, catch a bullet to the mind, now you clueless. Make you understand fully how it feels to be foolish. Prosecutor trying to say I'm an extremist, cause everything I say they believe it. And I be on some left shit, down to the death shit. 40 cal pop, leave a cop a breathless. What you know about it, hey, bro, you know I'm about it. I hit him with another one, I think I'm DJ Khaled. It's that Papa Pig challenge, hashtag fuck the flag. Yeah, red, white, and blue, ooh, throw it in the trash. Yeah, government is boo-boo, it's time to wipe some ass. Yeah, I be on some other shit that kind of hard to pass. And you can feel it in your gut, you know that you fed up. When the feds hit the block with SWAT blowing it up, cause these cops act tough with tanks and army guns, but never feel safe when they ain't got one. So how they gonna say that they protect and serve us when all they ever do is arrest and murder us? They don't really want no beef. Dressed in all black and we run in the streets. ATAB. Now we ain't never scared of no punk police.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
To close the gate, we are just the police. Intelligence is not our forte.
That little piggy gate who need a city to train, cause it take almost 8 of us to fucking close up a gate. What can I say? Firework go bang all in my face. It almost hit me in the head like any nose milkshake. Little Tifa, y'all be mean to Mr. Clean, huh? I'm finna back up, call for backup cause we need them. Maybe if we had like 3 more on the scene, we close the fence, no offense, but I think the fence is resisting arrest, ayy.
Someone get my baton, I'm finna be dead for breaking the law. You better comply when I play God, you better comply when I play God.
And we finna go crash your music scene cause y'all ain't playing no Nickelback.
Hey, yo, hold up my man, I'm tryna get the donuts out of your pack.
We don't know how to close the gate. We are just the police, intelligence is not our forte. Ooh, I don't know what forte means.
property damage to me is not violence. It's not a human life. I don't know how we can talk about damaging windows in the same breath of talking about Tort getting shot and killed and shot over 13 times. What I am worried about is the loss of trust in the public. What I am worried about is the fact that the public feels so helpless that they're being driven to this. We've heard time and time again, we talk about being the birthplace of the civil rights movement. Well, civil rights leaders all have said that when the public, that riots and protests are the voices of the unheard. People feel driven to this point, and we have to take it. We also have to look at ourselves and take responsibility for that. We are very complicit in the property damage that has taken place, the things that the city is calling violent. We push for those things to happen by not listening to the public. And so to sit here and point fingers and not take any responsibility or any of the blame is a failure in leadership. We shouldn't even be out there. This is what APD has no legal jurisdiction on the planet. We should not be out there sending what's estimated $40,000 a day for officers, like to send officers for these patrols. One should not even be there. This planet has the jurisdiction of the CAB and the state. But that being said, the escalation is troubling. It scares the ever-living crap out of me because I was terrified when the first arrests happened in the forest right before Christmas. And I said to my colleagues, if we do not come together now and get the administration up to the table, someone's going to die. And that is what happened. And my worst fears came true because somebody whose death was completely preventable ended up happening, and my fear is with continued escalation that number of people that will be injured and or killed will only grow, and that terrifies me because our responsibility should be first protecting civilians. I don't like whether or not they're from here. It doesn't matter. A human life is a human life. So, what's more important, winning the argument or protecting people? Which is why we need to take a beat and come back to the table and have a lot of questions and figure out how we're going to move forward. And why in God's name are we carrying the water for APF? Makes no sense to me. And the fact that as an elected official, cannot get certain questions answered and have tried now for months, which is why you haven't heard me say anything, because I was trying really hard to get more buy-in, to get more answers, and that has not happened. So, I still have questions about the lease, when that will actually be used, how it will be used. The general setup, if I hear one more damn time, it's not really a forest, I'm going to rip my hair out. The questions I have are around the kind of the niche pieces around hot softwood versus hardwood, how the trees are going to be planted, how wildlife is going to be protected, how are they going to not further pollute one of the most endangered water basins in the country. How are they going to mitigate the cost of water for the surrounding black and brown populations? The CSAC board makes no sense to me. There are people on there that are calling for there to be a halt, and that's not happening. That's the reason that they're supposed to be there. Some, in my opinion, have a conflict of interest because they're related to officers. APF has a vote on that committee. They absolutely should not have a vote on their own project. These are the questions I've got answers to, understanding what type of explosives would be used, how they're going to atone for the fact that we're proposing building a facility on a graveyard of people that died at the prison farms because of brutal conditions by police. How are we going to protect the Chattahoochee Brick Factory and not the place where the bodies were sourced from? Just all of it. What is it like, are there going to be any restrictions on the 43% of people coming here? Are we going to make sure that none of them have a training facility, like a training program similar to Gilead, Georgia State? Are we going to make sure we're not working with people who do IQ capping? Are we going to make sure that we're not working with agencies that are still practicing the same techniques that got George Floyd killed? There are so many questions that have not been answered. And also 90 million, where does this arbitrary number come from? And also, isn't it more than that now? How much of this are we covering? And there's just so many things that have not been answered. And closing our eyes and hoping it goes away, it's not a tactic. Oh, Chief is in here. Maybe I can go ask him some questions. Do y'all mind?
What did we come to do? comrades burn their Wendy's to the ground. We ask the city of Atlanta for a Rayshard Brooks Peace Center and the defunding of the police. And what was their response? The best we can give you, Top City. When we ask the city of Atlanta to at least listen to community and understand that 70% of those who were allowed to give public comment said that Cotton City was only going to further hinder our community, the city of Atlanta said, the best we can give you is to silence your voice. When we ask the city of Atlanta to at least allow us to peacefully demonstrate, allow our comrades to go live in the trees, protect our forests, the best that the city of Atlanta said we can give you is murder, repression, mass arrest, domestic terrorism charges. Fuck 12. So when the city of Atlanta asked us to adhere to some concept of law and order, we need to tell them that the best that we can give them is rebellion. Now I may be a little bit selfish in my reason for being here. I want to be free. I want my children to be free. I want my mother to be free. I want my father and my brothers and sisters to be free. And I don't want to have to live a life in 10 years when my babies, my nieces, and my nephews come to me and ask, Kamasi, where were you? What were you doing when they destroyed our clean water, destroyed our clean air? What happened? Why were you not around? What were you doing? When my babies come in 10 years and they say, Kamasi, what were you doing when your country turned into a massive dystopia? What were you doing? Where were you? Where you around? I can't sit here and sit back and say, I just sat home and watch this whole world burn to hell. Okay.
Police raid on the music festival that took place in the Atlanta Forest this weekend, and the indiscriminate usage of domestic terrorism charges should sicken and chill every person with conscience in this country. However, there is something beautiful in last night that I think is important for all of us to remember. Festival goers were closed in upon by the police, by the stage. They linked arms. and they demanded that they would not leave unless they could leave together and without arrest. Let me say that again. They refused to leave unless they could leave together. And I think this is a powerful reminder to us all that our solidarity is what keeps us safe. Take it with you as a tactic. Take it with you as an ethos. Take it with you as a memento for a beautiful music festival that inspired hundreds of people. But do not forget, our solidarity is beautiful. Our solidarity is what keeps us safe. Sometimes our solidarity is all we've got.
Activists, community groups, faith leaders, abolitionists, students, artists, and people from all over. But police, prosecutors, and even Governor Kemp have been trying to suggest in the media and in court that the opposition to Cop City is actually the work of a criminal organization whose members conspire to commit acts of terrorism. In essence, they're trying to concoct a RICO-like story about the movement. Second, based on a statement made by an Atlanta police officer, we understand that an indictment against activists is forthcoming, likely in the coming week. Third, based on a conversation between a defense attorney who's representing activists and the state prosecutor assigned to those cases, they believe that a RICO indictment against movement participants is forthcoming.
The city of Atlanta and the state of Georgia are working together to repress the Stop Cop City movement. Just as historically, the state has always tried to repress movements to fight for people's rights and liberties. Just as in the past, it was the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement that was targeted by the state, now we have movements today which are fighting against police violence and police militarization, which are also being targeted by the state. We must stand strong and stand together and fight against these efforts to repress our movement.
The state attempts to maintain power through the use of arrests, criminal prosecutions, and the threat of jail or prison, to name just a few. We call this state repression because this is the way the state attempts to crush or limit people's power to organize and advocate against harm. When political efforts are successful, when they grow in numbers and support, the state attempts to fight back against those wins with the tools of state repression. State repression is intended to stop your campaign and scare you into submission. The antidote for this is to demonstrate that you will not be scared into silence and inaction, and that your political work will continue with strategic effectiveness. Whenever political movements are successful, particularly when you are fighting against a massive police training facility that will train cops to maraud civilians, quell dissent, you should expect the state to utilize its power of repression against your growing movement. One way the state thinks it can crush environmental and social justice movements is by threatening or attempting to prosecute activists, organizations, and campaigns for racketeering. Known to many as RICO charges, the state tries to wield this tactic of repression because it thinks activists are afraid of being charged with RICO. RICO is just another felony charge, like the domestic terrorism charges. But the state believes that it can devalue popular political movements by attempting to rebrand the movement as a criminal enterprise instead of a constitutionally protected, democratic political movement. The overwhelming majority of thoughtful people see through this manipulation and abuse of power for what it is, a bully scare tactic. There's no way to avoid state stupidity, but there are many things that you can do to build resiliency and reduce harm. Know that thousands of political activists have been targeted by state power because of their powerful and encouraging organizing and activism efforts. Some have prevailed against state attacks and their movements gained power, even when imprisoned, gravely harmed, because they remained strong and demonstrated ethics and integrity. Know your rights. Do not cooperate with the state to do harm to yourself, your comrades, or the political movements you support. And trust that there is a strong and vigorous legal support structure in place to defend you if needed.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is from the Atlanta Community Press Collective. The NLG Atlanta chapter condemns the arrest of our legal observers and all detainees during the March 5th Willani Forest Defenders concert and remains in solidarity with the movement of Stop Cop City. Release the legal observers now, said Jennifer Jones, chair of the NLG News Mass Defense Committee. The National Lawyers Guild of Atlanta chapter condemns the arrest of our legal observers and detainees during the March 5th Willani Forest Defenders concert and remains in solidarity with the movement of Stop Cop City. Release the legal observers now. Southern Poverty Law Center tweets, law enforcement detained at least 35 demonstrators in Atlanta on Sunday, including SPLC employee who was arrested while acting and identifying as a legal observer on the behalf of National Lawyers Guild and Stop Cop City. Southern Poverty Law Center continues, this is a part of a month-long escalation of policing tactics against protesters and observers who oppose the destruction of the Willani Forest to build a police training facility. The SPLC will continue to urge de-escalation of violence and police use of force against Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, working in partnership to dismantle white supremacy, strengthen intersectional movements, and advance the human rights of all people. And at SPLCenter.org, the NLG and SPLC statements on arrest of legal observers members. To make Press Center inquiries, email press@splcinter.org. The National Lawyers Guild and Southern Poverty Law Center issued statements in response to the arrest of legal observers on Sunday, March 15th in Atlanta. NLG states, law enforcement detained at least 35 demonstrators in Atlanta on Sunday, including NLG legal observers. All these arrests are part of ongoing state repression and violence against racial and environmental justice protesters who are fighting to defend their communities from the harms and militarized policing and environmental degradation. Each of these instances, including the many protesters charged with domestic terrorism, make clear that law enforcement views movement activists as enemies of the state. As trained witnesses of police conduct, NLG legal observers serve as an important role in supporting movement organizers and activists. NLG is proud to contribute in whatever ways we can to advancing the critical work of our movement allies advocating for liberation and community care. NLG remains in solidarity with the movement to stop Cop City. The Southern Poverty Law Center goes on to add, an employee of the SPLC was arrested without acting and identifying as a legal observer on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild. The employee is an experienced legal observer, and their arrest is not evidence of any crime, but the heavy-handed law enforcement intervention against protesters. This is part of a month-long escalation of policing tactics against protesters and observers who oppose the destruction of the Willani Forest to build a police training facility. The SPLC has and will continue to urge de-escalation of violence and police use of force against Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, working in partnership with these communities to dismantle white supremacy, strengthen intersectional movements, and advance the human rights of all people. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
Nigga got it bad cause I'm brown and not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on and thrown in jail. We can go toe to toe in the middle of a sale. Fucking with me cause I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager, searching my car looking for the product, thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. You rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in a Benzo. Be the police out of shape, and when I finish, bring the yellow tape.
I came here to stop Cop City. What did you all come here to do?
Stop Cop City!
What did we come to do?
Stop Cop City!
What did we come to do?
Stop Cop City!
Why were you not around? What were you doing? When my babies come in 10 years and they say, Kamasi,
What were you doing when this country turned into a fascist dystopia? What were you doing? Where were you when you were around? I can't sit here and sit back and say I just sat home and watched this whole world burn to hell.
Okay.
I don't believe in the power. I don't believe in the power of the imperialists. I believe in the power of the people.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This comes from GrassrootsThinking.com, February 1st, 2023, on ending the police occupation and terrorism against black people. Our demands, a people-powered solution. Community movement builders agree with the people's demand not only to defund and eventually abolish the police force, but also call for demilitarization and decentralization of all policing institutions in the United States. As the rebellion raged, city, state governments attempted to pacify protesters by firing so-called bad apples, insisting on more training, changing the names of programs and task force, taking down Confederate monuments, appointing commissions to study issues, and moving money around. Community movement builders maintain that radical change will only take place when black communities control their own institutions to resolve their own conflicts and keep themselves safe. Community movement builders call for a people's assembly and a people's community patrol in order to envision and establish a restorative and transformative justice system that views black people as humans. We understand the ongoing rebellion as the people's expression of their democratic will. For over 50 years, black radicals, among others, have exposed the ways in which the voting electoral system in the U.S. is manipulated to favor candidates who safeguard racial capitalism and endless war. To do so, community movement builders propose that the total funding allocated to police departments and corresponding programs and task force be diverted to organize, carry out, and implement the results of people's assemblies and people community patrols. In the meantime, community movement builders demand the following reforms. Number one, only non-lethal arms can be used for purposes of self-defense. Police use of potentially lethal weapons can only be exercised under specific instances that endanger the general public, like mass shootings, hostage situations, etc. Number two, all military and police troops will immediately withdraw from the streets to allow protesters to occupy public space. Number three, cash bail system will immediately end and all current inmates being held for the inability to pay money bail will be immediately released from custody. Number four, all current inmates who are age 60 and older who require quarantine because of their positive corona test results or have existing health conditions that make them more susceptible to coronavirus, including chronic lung disease, asthma, diabetes, heart conditions, liver disease, obesity, pregnancy, or other conditions identified by health professionals in ongoing research will immediately be released from custody. Number five, all youth detention centers and residential facilities should be reformed to support a pathway for youth reentry into larger societies as soon as possible, with needed resources to provide housing, clothes, food, and access to education. Resources should be reallocated to implement programs focused on social-emotional learning, the hiring of more in-house counselors and therapists to work with our youth on a daily basis while serving these sentences or awaiting trial. Number six, all remaining political prisoners on U.S. territories will be immediately released from custody. This includes, but not limited to, organizers from the Black Panther Party, the Republic of New Africa, the Black Liberation Army, the Weather Underground, the American Indian Movement, and MOVE. Number seven, all detainees in immigration detention centers will be immediately released from custody. Number eight, police departments will immediately decertify, fire, or suspend without pay any officers involved in the use of deadly force against unarmed civilians pending investigation and ensuing trial. Number nine, police departments will fire officers who have multiple complaints of excessive force and their partners who silently witnessed such acts and or who assisted them in falsifying evidence. Number 10, police departments will fire officers whose actions out of uniform are violent, including social media hate speech, sexual assault, and domestic violence. Number 11, all police records will be made available to the public. Number 12, police officers without complaints of excessive force on the job at home will remain until the departments are phased out and will be subjected to routine psychological and risk assessment evaluations, including racial ethnic bias, to determine fitness to transition them to the new system. Number 13, independent civilian review boards with subpoena power will be established. No law enforcement personnel can serve on these boards. No police departments, appointed police commissioners, or elected officials who have the power to overturn disciplinary decisions. Taking into account gentrification, metrics such as zip codes will be used to ensure the eligibility and participation of community residents on these boards. Number 14, District Attorney Office, in conjunction with the Independent Civilian Review Board, will review all civilian fatalities on the hands of the police for the period of 2000 to 2018. Reviewers will identify cases of excessive and unlawful uses of force for investigation and trial. Number 15, an independent prosecutor will be identified to prosecute all cases of misconduct of police officers. Number 16, police departments will terminate all contracts with military and mercenary consultants, in particular any of the contracts with the Israeli Defense Force or any subsidiary that trains police in the U.S. to use the same deadly tactics used against Palestinians fighting for their own human rights. Number 17, police departments will cease to purchase any additional tanks and armored weapons and will immediately dispose of any and all such equipment in their possession. Number 18, police presence will be removed from all public schools. Number 19, recruiters of any armed forces will be permanently removed from all public schools. Number 20, police presence will be removed from all social service welfare agencies, including public housing. 21, police officers will no longer serve as first responders to mental health, substance abuse, and domestic violence calls. Instead, a team of mental health, substance abuse, and domestic violence counseling, conflict resolution, and social work professionals will intervene. 22, minor offenses like turnstile jumping, vending without a permit, a broken taillight, failure to signal, expired tags, and other nonviolent offenses that currently warrant bookings, impounding a vehicle, or pretrial incarceration will no longer be penalized or criminalized. 23, marijuana will be decriminalized and all sentences of those arrested for nonviolent drug offenses will be retroactively vacated. And number 4, police departments shall no longer seize and auction off property of arrestees who have not been convicted of any crime. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
a policeman or to be president. Right now, I think the honorable thing to do is to be a criminal.
Breaking story from AtlantaAntifa.org. Info sheet on far-right targeting forest defenders, January 2023. Be on the lookout for journalists, quote-unquote, from platforms you're not familiar with. Nathan DiMaggio, a white power activist, may be on the ground and is living in Atlanta. Other journalists like Kaylin DeAlameda from Frontlines, funded by Turning Point USA, and Jackson Elliott of Epic Times, which is funded by the far-right Falun Gong cult, have both been on the ground in Atlanta. In general, media coverage can be very helpful in combating the distortions of police propaganda, but we also advise activists to be extremely careful with who they speak to. To err on the side of caution and silence, and to only speak to trusted and known sources. We appreciate any and all tips on suspicious individuals. Please email afainatl@riseup.net. Who is Nathan DiMaggio? Nathan DiBaggio is a founder and ex-leader of the now-defunct white supremacist organization Identity Europa. He moved to Atlanta last year and is staying at the house of white supremacist lawyer Sam Dickinson in Buckhead. See our website for more details. His new project is called the William McKinley Institute. Be aware that Nathan DiBaggio is known for violence, 2 convicted assaults, and 1 racially motivated, and also for being short. Who is Kalen D'Almadia? Almadia is known for dressing in black bloc in order to infiltrate protests. He does not live in Atlanta, but was on the ground in our city in late January 2023. Jackson Elliott. Elliott visited the Atlanta Forest on January 23rd, 2022 to write a hit piece on the forest defenders, accompanied by a bizarre series of pictures of items left on the ground after police raids. You can reach Antifa Atlanta at afainatl@riseup.net. Phone number 470-344-4868. Voicemail only. Website atlantaantifa.org. Mastodon collectiva.social at Atlanta Antifa. Twitter at twitter.com/afainatl. Facebook, you can find them at afaintl. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
mixed with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But we're all fucking peasants as far as a working class hero is something to be.
Hi everyone, it could happen here, and today what we're talking about is a case in Asheville, North Carolina, where a group of people doing mutual aid work with unhoused people have been charged with felony littering. Now we're going to get a little bit in the episode into what felony littering is, and we're going to talk to Sarah. Sarah is one of the people facing these felony littering charges. Sarah's also been banned from parks in Asheville, and which we're going to talk about. So Sarah will explain a little bit of the process that led up to those felony littering charges, what the situation is like in Asheville for mutual aid and for unhoused people.
My name is Sarah Norris. Mostly like what I am is a mom of a little kid. I'm a social work student. I am a career educator. I am also, one of 16 local organizers who has been facing for almost the last year felony littering charges in conjunction with a December 2021 arts-based protest.
So let's maybe start off with like the situations before this. What were you all doing in the parks that led to you being deemed unsuitable for parks?
I can talk about what I did in parks for the year prior to being banned. And I was part of a collective who, at the beginning of the pandemic, did like 6 times a week meals, coffee, gear distribution in parks. By the time I came around and started participating in these food sharings, in these community gatherings, we were at like 2 or 3 times a week. And the way I spent my time in parks was Saturdays and Sundays. I brought my daughter to Aston Park. We brought food with us, gear with us, art supplies with us, or nothing with us. We just showed up as us. And we hung out and we distributed food, tents, packs, socks, toothbrushes, really whatever we could get our hands on. And towards the end of the year, we got a little bookshelf, and we were in charge of bringing books on this like little white plastic shelf, and like talking to people about what they most wanted and seeing if we could match them up with whatever we randomly had. It was really like sitting in the sunshine and making sure the coffee thing was full, and mostly just talking to people who are unhoused, people who are housed, people who walked by and were like, what's this? What's this picnic? Why is everybody like using glitter glue? Like, oh, because there's a 5-year-old and that's what we do. So that's what mostly I did in parks. And this activity is in the context of a city who, I think in 2021, at least 21 sweeps of homeless encampments. A sweep, like that name for some of us really connotes violence, but I think it's important to name how violent those are. A camp sweep means that folks have to leave the place where they've been living, and very often their belongings are then considered to be trash, are bulldozed over, are at a minimum lost to them. And this has happened over and over again in the city of Asheville. Yeah, there's a way that being in the park weekly felt like a thing that happened in Asheville that was the opposite. We're here. We're all here together. The protest itself around which, in the context of which, like, these arrests have come, happened in December and was an arts-based protest and was really about, was in favor of sanctuary camping in the city of Asheville with sanitation services. That was the point of it. There were like kind of standard protest related events arrests on Christmas night. So that's what Asheville police did. And yeah. I think it's important just to note that there were not unhoused folks evicted that night on Christmas night. And no one who was there was pretending to be unhoused and was arrested. That's a strange narrative that the City of Asheville Police Department has said in open court. But there were standard sort of like misdemeanor trespass resisting officer arrests that night, including of journalists. And then these felony littering cases came much later and in kind of a different context. But that's what happened around Christmas.
At some point, a letter comes to your door saying that you've been charged with felony littering.
So my own experience was that people, organizers in the Mutual Aid Collective that I'm part of, who had been showing up in the park week after week distributing food and gear, started getting arrested in mid-January for what we learned was something you could be arrested for, which was felony littering and or aiding and abetting felony littering. And some people had one, some people had the other, some people had both. Our understanding is that there's an unstated but generally followed policy by the City of Asheville Police Department that they don't go arrest people at work, but they went to people's work with 5 cops and arrested them. And this began in mid-January. It continued into February, and like honestly, the charges on the charge sheets would read like crazy statutes that weren't even felony littering. It seemed like they were making it up as they went along. Just from the what I can say is, I mean, I can't speculate about what they were doing, but there was a strangeness to even like the documentation that people who were arrested received. And then in the first week of March of last year, the letter that I received was similar to other folks received that day, which was in an envelope from the Asheville Police Department, but was on Asheville Parks and Rec stationery, that told me that I had been banned from all city parks for a period of 3 years based on the commission of a felony. And this was how I found out that I even had any charges, was through this letter. That's true for a few defendants. You know, not everybody who is now, we understand, to be banned from parks has even received one of those letters. But I did, and a few of us did. And there was on there a sort of like, if you would like to appeal this, you have 7 days. But the letter had been dated sort of 5 days before then. And we were like, wow, what are we even doing? And so it's hard to really communicate the like level of desperation and nonsense that was involved. You know, so a few of us found this out. We self-surrendered. And because we were a lot of us around the courthouse and City Hall, we were trying to figure out, what do these letters even mean? Like, what does it mean to appeal this? What does it mean to be banned? And so we traipsed around City Hall, city offices, the courthouse, trying to get some sort of answer. Like, what? Here, we've got these. What does this mean? And every place sent us somewhere where they were like, we don't know what that is. Parks and Rec said, we don't know what that is. Go talk to the police. We said, we don't know what that is. Go talk to the magistrate. The criminal magistrate said, oh, this seems like a civil magistrate thing. So there's like a group of five mutual aid workers just traipsing around trying to find out, like, do I get to go give out sandwiches and tents in the park this week or not for 3 years? Like, what if, and who can help me figure this out? And no one could. And what ensued? We never got an answer that day. We just had city employees looking at us. We're sorry this is happening to you. This seems really dumb. Eventually, via email, it became clear that they were like, we don't know what this process is, but we're going to tell you soon. Like, thank you for your email, you know, saying you're going to appeal it. And over time, we kind of got a little bit more like, okay, we're going to schedule the hearing. You will have a hearing. Eventually, like, okay, we asked, who will be the hearing? For what? What is a hearing? And they didn't know. And then like, oh, okay, well, there will be some police officers there and, you know, the city, a representative from the city attorney's office, and you will have a chance to provide information. At this point, we're dealing with felony littering charges that we don't understand. We're trying to figure out whether we can continue to provide community care in the way we've been doing for years. And it seems like what the city is offering is a chance to come and maybe entrap ourselves. Like, it doesn't make any sense to us. And so, you know, those of us who had representation that we could speak to said, oh, we're coming. Have you heard the recording? Mine is particularly, I can't listen to mine. I have a huge nervous system response. But mine is my attorney asking over and over again questions of the representative, the city attorney. It's John Maddox, who's named in the ACLU demand letter. Just saying over and over again, like, at that point, we hadn't even seen any discovery. Like, we don't know what information this is even based on. Like,
right.
There are two cops in uniform pointing body cams at, I have to assume pointing body cams at me and in this hearing. And my lawyer is just asking over and over again, like, upon what evidence is this based? And they just said over and over again, you are here to give information. We are not giving any information. My lawyer asking, what is the standard of review here? Like, upon what is this based? And the parks director just saying, like, my decision. And then what is the remedy if the appeal is denied? There's none, then the appeal is denied. And so it really was, for me, one of the moments where I realized, like, the city is pretty hell-bent on keeping a bunch of sweethearts who give out 10 cent sandwiches out of the park, and they're gonna, like, they're up to something here. Like, pseudo in a dangerous and extrajudicial way. Like, I had no protections there.
Yeah, like these are Star Chamber proceedings. Like the King of France is gonna walk out. Like, this is halfway through this.
I was just thinking, it seems like such a British thing. Like,
yeah.
You told me this was in Britain, and you'd been like shooting the Queen's swans or something. I'd buy it, you know. But, here we are in the land of the free, no less.
Well, and I think the equivalent of shooting the Queen's swans here is hanging out with poor folks in a park in ways that inconvenience, or that apparently inconvenience, the folks who pay money because you have to play tennis at a public tennis court, which is like right by Aston Park. And we can go in a minute as much as you want to what you saw as far as like their attempts to sneak through an ordinance. Now we know quite clearly from public records directed at food sharing in Aston Park.
Yeah, it's really, I keep thinking about that Helder Camara line. When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why they are poor, they call me a communist. It's like they really seem to have blown all the way past. Like, they didn't even get to part two. They were just like, wait, hold on, you're giving food to the poor? Like, it is time for a military response?
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is from Politico.com. DHS has a program gathering domestic intelligence, and virtually no one knows about it. Collecting information from Americans raises ongoing civil liberties concern. Virtually unknown, DHS program allowed officials to go directly to incarcerated people, circumventing their lawyers for interviews, raising important civil liberties concerns, according to legal experts. For years, the Department of Homeland Security has run a virtually unknown program gathering domestic intelligence, one of many revelations in a wide-ranging tranche of internal documents reviewed by Politico. Those documents also reveal that a significant number of employees in DHS intelligence offices have raised concerns that the work they're doing could be illegal. Under the Domestic Intelligence Program, officials are allowed to seek interviews with just about anyone in the United States. That includes people held in immigration detention centers, local jails, and federal prisons. DHS intelligent professionals have to say they're conducting intelligence interviews, and they have to tell people they seek to interview that their participation is voluntary. But the fact that they're allowed to go directly to incarcerated people, circumventing their lawyers, raises important civil liberty concerns, according to legal experts. That specific element of the program, which has been in place for years, was paused last year because of internal concerns. DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis, which runs the program, uses it to gather information about threats in the U.S., including transnational drug trafficking and organized crime. But the fact that this low-profile office is collecting intelligence by questioning people in the U.S. is virtually unknown. The inner workings of the program called the Overt Human Intelligence Collection Program are described in a large tranche of internal documents Politico reviewed from the Office of Intelligence and Analysis. Those documents and additional interviews reveal widespread internal concerns about legally questionable tactics and political pressure. The documents also show that people working there fear punishment if they speak out about the mismanagement and abuses. The survey is taken from spring 2020 through May 2021, spanning much of the year of the Trump administration and the four-month Biden's term. It shows that numerous areas people working in INA were more concerned about their workplace than working at other U.S. intelligence agencies. Those areas include experiences with distortion, suppression of analysis, Dobbich added in her email to multiple officials about the survey that protecting bureaucracy's interests surfaced as an important factor in the most significant distortion of suppression experience. She added that INA has come a long way in improving its analytical processes since the survey was conducted. Dobbich has connected with the IA's biggest recent controversies, the decision in the summer of 2020 during the last year of the Trump administration to direct IA's intelligence collectors to treat the protection of all public monuments, memorials, and statues as part of their mission. In July 1st, 2020, Dobbich emailed out a job aid, meaning an instruction document, from the Office of Intelligence Law Division and IA's activities in furtherance of protecting American monuments, memorials, and statues, and protecting the George Floyd murder surrounding the federal courthouses and clash with police. A few weeks later, on July 23rd, Dobbich sent another email lamenting leaks about IA's activities related to Portland, Oregon, where large groups of people protesting the George Floyd murder surrounded the federal courthouse and clashed with police. She also praised the work IA was doing there and strongly defended that it was fully within the office's authority. But problems were brewing. The following week, in July 30, the Washington Post reported that IA had published intelligence reports on journalists covering the events in Portland. The next day, the Post reported that IA had viewed protesters' messages on Telegram, including communications about protest routes and avoiding police. DHS then used the information in intelligence reports that shared with partners, according to the Post. And on August 1st, news broke that then-head IA Brian Murphy was being ousted from the role. A top lawyer from the office, Joseph Maher, who would later go on to work on the January 6th Select Committee, replaced him. And 2 weeks later, on August 14th, Maher sent a message in INA Workforce rescinding the job aid that Dobbich had sent out. Quote, "We have determined that in applying IA's collection and reporting authorities to threats to damage to destroy any public monument, memorial, or statue, rather than to a narrow category of threats to damage, destroy, and impede federal government facilities, including national monuments and icons." Spencer Reynolds, counsel for the Brennan Center of Justice in New York University and former DH intelligence counterterrorism attorney, told Politico that IA's mission makes it uniquely susceptible to political pressure. In recent years, the office political leadership, Democrat and Republican, pushed INA to take more and more expansive view of its mandate, putting officers in positions of surveilling Americans' views and associations protected by the U.S. Constitution, he emailed. There's a tendency to use office power to paint political opponents, be they left-wing demonstrators or QAnon truthers, as extremists and dangerous. This has had a disastrous impact on morale. Most people don't join in the intelligence community to monitor their fellow Americans' political, religious, or social beliefs. At the same time, leadership has sidelined INA's oversight offices, leaving employees with little recourse. The INA statement said that the office has brought on a research director tasked with ensuring INA products are free from political interference. The office also has hosted sessions with Ombudsman, the Office of Director of National Intelligence, focused on identifying, resisting, and reporting political pressure. According to the statement, the office has also embedded intelligence oversight personnel with INA open source intelligence team and widely communicated 24/7 points of contact for the Intelligence Law Division and Intelligence Oversight Officer. The documents also cast light on the virtually unknown programs run by the office that, in the views of some experts, raise civil liberties concern. The Overt Human Intelligence Collective Program, abbreviated as OHIC, Politico reviewed a document from 2016 detailing how the program should work, as well as emails from the last year about pausing part of the program. These emails show that even though the program has been running for years, officials overseeing it still feel more guardrails may be needed to protect Americans' rights. Under the rules outlined in the documents, the program's intelligence gathering can't be done secretly. INA's employees are supposed to receive special training on collecting human intelligence, meaning intelligence that comes directly from people rather than from satellite images, intercepted emails, or other sources. Those collectors also notify these supervisors arranged interviews with people they'd like to talk to. They can reach out to anyone, including government employees, people in the private sector, and importantly, personnel in Department of Homeland Security administrative detention, federal, state, local tribunal, territorial law enforcement, confidential informants, and personnel serving any type of criminal sentence who are incarcerated or on parole. DHS administrative detention includes immigrant detention centers around the country, as well as Customs and Border Protection facilities on the border. INA intelligence collectors can interview willing sources who voluntarily share information, the documents say. Before asking questions, collectors must explicitly state that they work for DHS, that participation is voluntary, that the interviewer or interviewee can end the interview at any time, and that the interviewee has no special rights to review or control how INA uses the information shared. Interviewers must also tell interviewees that they will not exercise any preferential or prejudicial treatment in exchange for the source's cooperation, the document says. There's also a lot that interviewers can't say, according to the document. They can't make any promises in exchange for information, including promises to help with criminal justice or immigration proceedings. They also can't imply that they hold any sway over deliberations of a judge, either criminal or immigration, or any government official with responsibilities related to the subject of the interview. They can't coerce, threaten, or otherwise intimidate the source of any person or object of value to that source. They also can't ask the source to conduct any activities. DHS should not be questioning people in immigration or criminal detention for human intelligence purposes without far stronger safeguards for their rights, Toomey said. While this questioning is supposedly voluntary, DHS policy ignores the coercive environment these individuals are held in. It fails to ensure that individuals who have a lawyer present, and it does nothing to prevent the government from using a person's words against them in court. Another element, people facing criminal charges often share information with the government in hopes of receiving leniency at sentencing. By participating in intelligence interviews without their lawyer's guidance, those opportunities could evaporate. And the policy specifically says INA collectors can't provide any help to the people they interview in exchange for information. Much remains unknown about the program and its impact. Collecting and human intelligence are two words that should never be associated with INA, never, says Bogner. It should be analytics and the state and local support. That's what should be associated with INA. INA did not provide comment specifically over human intelligence collection program. It is not known how many people conduct interviews under the program, how many people they interview per year, how many of those interviewees are incarcerated. The partial halt of human intelligence collection programs has described in Kreitner's email coming amid the further concerns about the legality of INA's activities expressed in internal surveys, underscores the challenges facing Weinstein and other IA leaders. And according to Reynolds, the former IA lawyer now at the Brennan Center, the office needs to take meaningful steps to reassure the public and congressional watchdogs. INA needs to refocus its approach, stop basing its intelligence activities on the constitutionally protected views of Americans, and stop treating vandalism and fistfights as terrorism. It needs meaningful engagement with its oversight offices and to listen to its personnel when they voice their concerns. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.